Aloha, it's Tuesday, March 17th. This is Robbie Dingman, in for Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. We survey the landscape after this weekend's Kona Lo. High winds and heavy rainfall pummeled our islands. And how does recent rainfall compare to years past? We dive deep into the numbers. What to do with those banana peels, chicken bones, and half a plate lunch you forgot about at home? You might not need to trash them. We learn about a new composting program launching on Oahu in 2 weeks. Why city officials are asking residents to include the food. We meet a chatty bush warbler whose unique song heralds spring's arrival on this week's Manu Minute. And a tattoo artist found fame on the continent, but an imprint of Maui on her heart led her back home. Happy St. Patrick's Day to those who celebrate or just like to wear green. Rushing streams, drumming rain, and whistling winds sounded across the islands this weekend as a record-breaking storm slammed the state. HPR's reporters checked in on communities during and after the storm. The city and county of Honolulu said 112 people visited shelters on Oahu over the weekend, along with 28 pets. HPR's Cassie Ordonio rode along with outreach workers from the nonprofit Kealaho West Oahu on Saturday as they tried to convince people to seek indoor shelter. She spoke with Kawi Respotnik, who has been homeless for several years, about how she planned to stay safe.
We just got to hold tight and just expect what's to come. That's about it. And just pray hard that nobody get hurt. That's our main thing, is that nobody get hurt. Like for my tent, it's safe. So I, you know, told everybody, if you guys tent go down, anything, you guys more than welcome to come to my tent. Yeah. So my tent is open to whoever. Yeah. It's about helping each other.
But do you think you guys would ever consider like seeking maybe shelter just in case?
No, because why? We have a lot of our belongings here and we don't want anybody to come and start stealing enough. We're struggling and get people out here that's stealing from us. That's sad. That is so sad because we're out here struggling.
HPR's Mark Ladau spoke with farmers on Oahu's North Shore as they were assessing the damage to their properties. Jason Witte is a co-owner of Thrive Hawaii Family Farm in Haleiwa, where he grows small-scale organic vegetables. He stood in a patch on the farm that Witte said had been filled waist-deep in water over the weekend. Witte estimates that the storm caused thousands of dollars in damage to his crops.
We've had some pretty significant damage at both of our properties. We have a property that we own in Mokulia that had heavy sustained winds that were strong enough to collapse a large greenhouse we just put up. And then we also have greenhouses in Haleiwa that survived structurally but were impacted. The plastic coverings and some of the nets were ripped, torn off. Drainage canals were completely filled and there was some standing water on about 50 to 60% of the property for a significant amount of time. We're pretty sure that standing water and disease will affect a pretty significant portion of our crops.
We also hear from Max Breen. Breen is head of operations at Kamana Nui Cacao Orchards in Waialua, where the storm dumped nearly as much rain over the past week as the farm normally gets in an entire year. The storm also destroyed its fence to keep out pigs. Breen was left wondering about the impact of the irrigation systems abandoned when the sugarcane industry shut down. He's looking at what's left behind, including Wahiawa Reservoir and Dam.
As a farmer in Hawaii, I'm very curious about like ag history, what this land used to be used for. And, you know, the biggest piece of that ag history and like recent memory is sugarcane. And, you know, sugarcane industry created this insane, intricate system of irrigation for especially up here in Waialua, North Shore of Oahu. Is Waialua Sugar Company was known for the complexity and the efficacy of their irrigation system. They built the largest reservoir at the time in Hawaii in Lake Wilson. And one thing we saw happen during the storm is everybody got an alert on their phone saying Lake Wilson Dam, the Wahiawa Dam, might fail. And that's 2.5 billion gallons of water that was going to rush down into Waialua and Haleiwa and like inundate those communities. So that really made me start think of, you know, okay, Lake Wilson didn't end up failing and like rushing down the mountain, but like what else did fail? And like I showed you what failed on our property, like an old reservoir, right? Like an old mini version of Lake Wilson that was just dirt, no concrete, but it created this massive gorge. And so like, it makes me think, we have all this insane infrastructure that hasn't been upkept, right? Because sugarcane left, there's no like big money incentive to upkeep it. But like, what risk does that crumbling infrastructure pose to us as farmers, but also our communities ultimately? And like, what would it look like if it was maintained slash like never put in there in the first place? I mean, that's a crazy like what if, right? But maybe the land before those systems were put in place, like the water ran more naturally.
The Valley Isle saw the heaviest rainfall this weekend, with some areas reporting nearly 4 feet of rain across 5 days. Wind and rain caused widespread power outages. More than 120,000 customers lost power on Friday, according to Hawaiian Electric. HECO estimates 5,500 customers on Oahu, Maui, and Hawaii Island remain without power this morning, with the majority on Hawaii Island. Tori Ho'opi'i lives in Wailuku, near Iao Valley. She tells HPR's Catherine Kluwet-Pachtel that she lost power for 3 days. It was just restored last night.
Early Saturday morning in the middle of the storm was about 12:30 a.m. And it was right when in the middle of the storm, the rain and the wind. And at 12:30, we heard three loud explosions. And it sounded like a shotgun, actually. It was right outside of our house. Right after that, we lost power. So where I live, it was a lot of very robust wind. I haven't experienced wind like that, like, since I've lived here. And the rain was just constant, just pouring. And like, even last night, and the water, like, it was like rivers of brown water was going down the street. And so my roof, even, I have three things leaking in my house. Like, we live in an old plantation camp. My house was built in 1930. So parts of my roof was leaking. My son and my husband had to go on top of our roof to try to put plastic to stop. I was like scared, like my roof was going to cave in. It was so wild. And like, my parents live at the top of our subdivision. Their roof was leaking. And we're just like, we've never experienced anything like this before.
Kyle Ellison is the founder of Malama Kula, a nonprofit started after the Maui fires. Ellison's organization has helped communities in upcountry Maui prepare for natural disasters. He tells us how his group communicated with emergency officials and other relief organizations during this storm.
We coordinated with Team Rubicon, a disaster relief organization that is just happened to have a Sawyer team on island right now, who we've coordinated with in the past. And we sent them a request for assistance, and they were able to mobilize some really advanced Sawyers up and cut open a number of driveways of you know, resident Kapuna who have medical issues. The family that had the 6-day-old baby that needed to get to the doctor. And there were many people who could not get out of their homes after this. And so we received lots of requests for simply just letting people gain access out of their driveways was the first step that we were prioritizing. And it's shifting into regular storm cleanup now, but still trying to make sure we address the most vulnerable and the people who are still cut off. Really from about the Kula Lodge area, from about Lower Kemo, Upper Kemo area by Kula Lodge, heading all the way south towards Keokea and Ulupalakua, and then beyond into Kanaio and Kahikinui. I mean, that south-facing slope seemed to catch the brunt of it. And things that we haven't seen before, I mean, rock slides, mud slides, a big cinder blowout, vehicles that are covered in multiple feet of mud. Multiple cars crushed by trees. We've seen a couple vehicles that were completely smashed by 100-foot trees that fell on them. Yeah, more than just your one or two tree down events. I mean, trees on houses, trees on cars, a lot of property damage. We were in good communication with Department of Public Works, and they were really responsive to our requests, where we would have people inbound us information about needs and roads that were closed, and we would get them that info, and they would have teams there opening up the roads in some pretty gnarly conditions pretty quickly. So I do think the county's responding pretty well to opening, you know, roadways and keeping areas clear. And just one other thing that I would reiterate, which is, you know, for future events for everyone all over Hawaii, is that just the importance of preparedness, where we had so many people write us going, I know I'm kicking myself for not owning a chainsaw, or I don't have a backup battery or a generator. I probably should have had one. And, you know, there's a pretty mass realization amongst people now of, hey, maybe we could have been better prepared. So that's definitely a conversation we're going to be having within our community is, you know, how can we better prepare our community for these events with the tools that they need? But right now we're still, that's down the road.
We've been hearing from community members around the islands impacted by the weekend's record-breaking storm. Did you feel prepared? We want to hear from you. Write to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also reach out on Facebook or Instagram. We are at WeAreHPR.
Aloha, this is DJ Mermaid, inviting you to a special Live from the Atherton storytelling event celebrating 65 years of Hawaii Youth Opera Chorus. Choral director Nola Nahulu will be joining me to discuss opera in Hawaii, plus special performances from the Youth Opera Chorus. This free event is Saturday, March 28th at 2 p.m. Tickets and details at hprtickets.org.
Sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA, celebrating over 87 years of dedication in supporting the health and well-being of the people of Hawaii with a commitment to caring for the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
We continue with a look at the numbers on this past weekend's storm. The Kona low shattered rainfall records, but was this a freak storm or the beginning of a worrisome pattern? Joining us live is Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Caitlin Thompson, who crunched the numbers. Good morning, Caitlin.
Good morning.
Thanks for doing what, you know, we all shudder about, making numbers understandable to all the rest of us. We appreciate that.
Yeah, you know, I was watching the weather over the weekend and really just thinking, this seems like an awful lot of rain. I wonder what the data shows. And yeah, crunching those numbers, it really was a very rainy weekend in a very rainy season.
Well, let's start with the beginning. Sorry to sound like a bad joke. How rainy was it?
Really rainy. It was a lot of rain. It really was. I think you know, we shattered a lot of records, which really surprised me. It was more than 12 inches of rain at the Honolulu airport. Kahului got almost 19 inches of rain in the last 6 weeks. So, you know, it's this storm was part of a broader picture over this past 6 weeks. Since early February, we've had a couple of big storms that brought a lot of rain. So it's not just this past weekend. It was the whole kind of six-week period that shattered so many records.
And when you talk about records, how long a record, for example, that was very wet at the airports, how far back did you have to go for that?
Yeah, so at the Honolulu airport, those more than 12 inches in the last 6 weeks, that's a record that stood for more than two decades. It's been really like since 2000 that it's been this rainy, since at least 2000 that it's been this rainy.
And when we talked about this a little earlier, how dry are the airports compared to some of the other areas across the island?
Yeah, you know, that's the interesting thing. So the airports are the National Weather Service official sites, but they also happen to be, especially on Oahu, they're kind of the drier spots on the islands. So there were other parts of the islands that got a lot more rain. You know, we saw 18 inches over this last storm alone near Manawili on Oahu. Some areas around there got even more than that. Upcountry Maui got an awful lot of rain, more than 6.5 inches in a three-hour period alone early Saturday morning. So, you know, just looking at the airports, we actually kind of missed the bigger picture. Across the state, it was a super rainy period.
Right. So we're not talking about a freak rainstorm that hit the airports. We're talking about something that doused the whole state for a longer amount of time, too?
Yeah, I think that this last storm was rainier than the one in February. If you'll remember, the one in February got quite a bit of rain. The state shut down. There was an emergency proclamation. But this last storm, the one that was from March 10 to March 15, got even more rain than that. So, for example, Honolulu Airport got 16 times more rain this most recent storm than the February storm. Kahului, 9 times more rain than the February storm. Lihue got 6 times more rain than the February storm. So, you know, on top of a really wet winter, we're also seeing this last weekend was really stood out. You know, March 13 was the rainiest day in the last 26 years in Kahului. March 13 was also the second rainiest day in Honolulu Airport since 2000. So, yeah, we're really, really shattering those records.
Yeah, we're going to remember that Friday the 13th.
Yeah, it was truly a downpour. And, you know, it had huge impacts all across the community. As you guys have been hearing, it was really devastating for a lot of communities.
Sure, we're hearing a lot of people saying they got more rain in the week than they had in a normal year.
And they're right. The data shows it.
That's impressive. Anything that really stood out to you? Anything surprised you that you really weren't expecting?
You know, I think for me, the thing that was the most surprising really was just how much we did see compared to previous years. You know, this is the first time since the early 2000s that we really got this much rain in this since the start of February in a bunch of different places in the state. So I think it was the thing that surprised me the most was just how different this was compared to previous years.
Well, we see it's raining some more and forecast to rain some more after that. Are you going to be keeping an eye on this in the future?
Oh, absolutely. We'll be following the data. We will be continuing to update this. I'm crunching those numbers still. You know, this week is predicting more rain. We're not through this yet, and my heart goes out to all communities that have been impacted. It's been really devastating, but we'll continue to follow along with the recovery efforts, the damage costs, and the amount of rainfall.
Yes, thanks, Caitlin. I think for all those who are deeply affected by it, it certainly helps when we can make some sense of it, and your stories are helping us do that. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
We've been hearing from Civil Beat reporter Caitlin Thompson. Check out her data dive online at civilbeat.org. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. We'll hear next about a pilot program on Oahu, where if it grows, it can go in your recycling. So for today's quiz, we're talking trash. Or more importantly, what we're doing with our refuse. The city county of Honolulu has been able to increase its recycling rates dramatically since its humble beginnings in 1988. Back then, we'd recycled a measly 78,000 tons of refuse. In 2023, the city had reprocessed a total of 615,000 tons of material from cardboard to car tires. And the H-Power waste-to-energy plant in Campbell Industrial Park processes over 700,000 tons of waste annually. This trash gets turned into a tenth of the island's electricity. But how much trash are we producing each day? For today's quiz, we want to know the total amount of waste that Oahu residents generate each day. It's Price is Right rules. Give us your answer in tons or in pounds, but if you guess over, no dice. Call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right wins a reusable HPR tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for families of agricultural workers and retirees, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation. NereidHawaii.com.
recycling food waste curbside is the goal of a new pilot program launching next month in 6 communities across Oahu. Folks would put their food scraps in the green waste bins collected every other week by the city's Department of Environmental Services. We recently spoke with Department Director Roger Babcock. His department is holding workshops this month and info meetings next month to explain the program's rollout on April 1st. The pilot starts in 6 communities, Waipahu, Nanakuli, Hawaii Kai, Mililani, Kailua, and Kalihi, and rolls out across the rest of Oahu in October. Babcock explained that 180,000 tons of the total waste stream is food waste, and about half of that is residential.
So this is residential curbside collection of food waste in the green compost bin. So we're calling that cart now the green composting cart because it's the green waste has always gone to become compost. With our contractor up in Wahiawa, Hawaii Earth Recycling, has always made compost out of that material for us. The initiative that took quite a while to get in place was for the food scraps. And that came into play. We had to bid out a contract, and then the contractor needed to build a new facility or basically do a massive upgrade to the facility to be able to get a permit to accept food waste. Because food waste is different than green waste. It's putrescible and would attract vectors and things like that. So it needs to be an enclosed facility, and it needs to have an impervious base. When you're just doing green waste, you can just kind of do that outdoors on the ground. And that is what the facility was like. Now it's a brand new facility. So that's been built. And now it's ready to start on April 1st to accept these food scraps. Ultimately, it will also be able to accept manufactured compostable materials. So those are all the compostable things that are labeled compostable on the packaging. Right now, we cannot accept that. Because that will be in the future, though, so that definitely will happen. But right now, it can't be accepted because some of that material contains PFAS, the forever chemicals, and we don't want that, you know, in the compost. And we're not permitted to accept that now.
So I know I do a little composting at home, so I know which things I put in and which things I don't put in. We could throw in old bananas into our green waste now, but in this case, you've added a number of things beyond plant material. So tell us what things consumers, what our listeners can put in.
Two things that we can say that maybe kind of make it helpful. One is include the food. That's one of our taglines. So anything that's food qualifies unless it's liquid. So semi-solid and solid, anything that's food can go in there.
Okay, so yogurt, not milk, for example.
That's right, yogurt, not milk. So we also say if it grows, it goes. So that means, you know, sort of plant material. But also meat is okay. Bones are okay of any size. So those are all food items. So the way it's processed is it's all ground up when it gets to the facility together. So it's not a problem if things can be ground up. And the only reason we can't take liquids is because it's got to go into your green cart. And then it has to go into a truck, right? And the trucks, you know, are not meant to carry liquids. So liquids are not allowed in rubbish or any of the carts, right? So the same thing. So it still applies because that's just going to spill out onto the road. So you can't put liquids in there. Well, sometimes it's easier to talk about what you can't put in there. You can't put in there pet waste. That's not food. You know, I guess if you get into more detail, people say, well, what about my cat doesn't eat all their food? And can I put that in there? Well, nope, that's not food. If you wouldn't eat it, it's not food scraps, right? So it's basically food scraps. Just in the big picture is that out of the entire waste stream of about 1 million tons a year, 180,000 tons per year is food waste that could be, you know, recycled into compost instead of going to H-Power and being burned and then ultimately the ash then going to the landfill. So whatever we can divert, this is part of a whole, you know, the whole recycling program. Anything we can divert out of that waste stream and get recycled instead is very positive. And the additional benefit of compost is it's a reusable material, right? And it's a locally generated valuable product that is otherwise imported, you know, from the mainland basically and far, far away. And we spend a lot of money for most of the compost that you buy at a nursery, for example.
Sure. And maybe you can add to that and tell people, so while they might hear, oh, well, we're helping build the city's compost, well, how can they benefit from that? How can they get the compost themselves?
So they can buy it from Hawaiian Earth Recycling. I think the brand name is Menehune Magic, and now it's upgraded and better because it will have the food waste in it.
Okay, so why, maybe explain, why start in 6 communities? How does that help do the program better?
So that way, we call it a pilot, but really it's just a phased rollout. The reason we want to do that is we want to get data. We want to collect data. We're going to look in carts. We're going to be measuring weights at the facility because everything that goes into the facility is weighed, right? And that's how we pay. We pay by ton. And we'll see how it's going, what people are putting in, what they're not putting in. But we need to collect data on what's working, what's not working. And then we want to try and ask people, why aren't you doing this? What are the barriers? Can we help you to make sure we get the word out? And then we'll have use that information to perhaps tailor our outreach to the rest of the island, you know, and we anticipate then having everybody online with this in October. So in between, we'll be trying to learn and improve the program and try and improve what people are doing. And we'll find out what issues there are, if any, what people are putting in there that maybe we don't want. Any kind of recycling contamination is the biggest challenge, right? Think about the blue mixed recyclables cart. You got 1 and 2 plastics, you got paper, you got glass, you got aluminum. That literally gets dumped in on the ground and then goes on conveyor belts, and people have to pull out each one and put it into bins so it can go somewhere to be recycled. So it's a very labor-intensive, challenging process. So the value is directly related to how pure and clean the waste streams are. We do plan to give away some countertop buckets, essentially, green buckets. These are common on the mainland that folks do this stuff too, where you can, and it has a lid that closes and seals, where people would put their daily food scraps into this bucket. It's kind of maybe like about a 1 gallon bucket. It's not very big, but it sits on your counter and it'll have labels on it and say what's acceptable and stuff. And then you can periodically, when it's full, you can take it out and dump it in your green cart, hopefully layered in between some green waste. And they're also going to be giving away these silicone bags that are about a 1 gallon bag. They're sealable. And that's for people who want to perhaps put stuff in that instead and maybe store it in the freezer. And then you can dump the frozen material into the green cart. And we remind people that one of the reasons we need to do recycling is not just because it's good and we keep organic material on the island and reincorporate into the soil and gardens and stuff, but also we all have to live on this small island and it's really hard to have a landfill. And so we really need to work all together on recycling. We basically are targeting 60,000 tons. It's super ambitious. The city really only collects about half of all of the rubbish. The other half is collected by private waste haulers, but it does all come to the city. We have to process all of it at either H-Power and the recycling facilities. So we're responsible for all of it, but we only collect half of it. And that's about 90,000 tons is food. So 60,000 tons out of the 90,000 is 2/3 of it. So it's very ambitious, but we hope to get there. And we really want to encourage people that you can do this. It's going to be okay. It's not going to stink necessarily. I mean, I think folks worry about those things, but I think we just have to, they're just going to have to try it. And if they're worried about that, then you might wait. That's why the idea of freezing, if you're worried about maybe your green cart becoming odorous, but it has a lid, vermin and rodents, nothing can get in there as long as you keep the lid closed, right?
Right. You had a very polite way of saying that, about the stinking and the rats and the bugs and sort of thing. But I think that's definitely one of the things people are going to worry about. And that's why you're giving them a choice between the countertop bucket and the bag you can freeze?
They're going to get both, so they can choose to use them however they want. But we're not just giving them out randomly or not passing them out to everybody. They're very expensive, actually. So you kind of got to go to one of the workshops and then you can get one and get one of each. And some people may decide, I'm going to do just my fruits and vegetable scraps, right? And that's fine. That's great. If you're not comfortable with putting meat, wastes, and bones in there, then, that's fine. It's really good for people to help and do their part on recycling, because the communities that have to host the landfill, they really are taking on a bit of a burden for the rest of us. And we really want to respect that and really try and do our part to recycle. It does matter. It does turn the stuff into something useful as opposed to burning it. And the other thing I wanted to mention that comes out in the workshops is that the first step is also to waste less food. Maybe I don't need to bring home that extra plate from, you know, the event that I was at, because I turn out I don't eat it. Maybe we buy less things too, right? That because we're not using all of it. So that's kind of another part of the message that I've been talking about as well.
Sure. I mean, I hope that's one of our pandemic lessons, that we shop in our fridge before we go buy something. I try not to buy one item anymore, you know?
Yeah.
You think, what have we got there? And you play Food Network at home. Okay, I can make it from this, that, and the other, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. And so I think then if people are collecting this material, then, you know, specifically, and not just throwing it in with everything in the rubbish, and then they may be more awareness, you know, of that. And that would be good for all of us too, right? If we buy less and waste less, that's great.
That was Roger Babcock, director of the city's Environmental Services Department. The city just last year began recycling electronic waste like computers and cables at convenience centers across the island. Babcock expects paperboard can go in the blue bins for recycling within the year. The next workshops for the compost pilot program will be held this Thursday in Nanakuli and Friday in Waipahu. Apartments and condominiums are not included in the program at this time. Residents can drop off food scraps at Hawaiian Earth Recycling in Waihewa. There's a lot more information available on the city website at honolulu.gov/env/grow.
On the next Fresh Air, insights into Iran's new Ayatollah. We talk with Karim Sajadpour, senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He says President Trump was hoping for a scenario like Venezuela, where President Delcy Rodriguez is cooperating with Trump. In Iran, Trump may have produced another Kim Jong-un. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Support for HPR comes from Scale Staffing, providing offshore staffing and recruitment for audit, finance, and accounting functions. Learn more about services at scalestaffing.co.
We now go to this week's Manu Minute. Today we're highlighting a shy songbird whose distinctive melody signals spring's arrival, thanks to the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology for today's recordings. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart.
Japanese bush warblers are small, mostly brownish songbirds with a distinct white eyebrow or superciliary line above their eyes. Because they spend most of their time in dense understory vegetation, they're really hard to see, but it's their loud, very distinctive song that gives them away. There are two main types of song. The first has a long introductory whistle ending in a syllable. The second is mostly a long descending series of double notes. Known as uguisu in Japanese, they're one of the best known and loved songbirds in Japan. And after a long winter, that song is viewed as one of the first signs of spring. It's sung only by the males to advertise their territories and try to attract females. These birds are also highly regarded for their droppings, which are the main ingredient in a very effective skin cream that's been used in Japan for centuries. Hawaii is the only place in the world where Japanese bush warblers have become established outside their natural range. They were first introduced to Oahu in 1929 to control insects, and expanded on their own to all the other main Hawaiian islands, most recently making the long flight to the Big Island in the 1990s. Sexes are similar in plumage, but the males are almost half again as heavy as the females. Unlike most other songbirds that are monogamous, male Japanese bush warblers are polygynous, where a male sets up a territory and pairs up with multiple nesting females. Japanese bush warblers are found in a variety of native and non-native forests across the state. and seem particularly attracted to areas of dense uluhe fern, where there are often very few other bird species. We still don't know a lot about their ecology here in Hawaii, but at least for now, they don't seem to be having a significant negative impact on our native birds or forests. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from the Hawaii Audubon Society. For more than 8 decades, fostering community values that work to protect Hawaii's native birds and ecosystems. Learn more about membership and other ways to help at hiaudubon.org.
That moment of hope was real but brief. In the third week of the war, as Iran has stated, Mujtaba Khamenei as its supreme leader, and there's no signs that it's going to change its policies or make any major concessions, Iranians are afraid.
I'm Michael Barbaro. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
We had no winners on the backyard quiz. We stumped you. So now it's time to dispose of the answer to today's quiz. It should be no surprise that we generate tons of trash each day, from plastics to glass and old newspapers to electronic scraps. It's in our nature to get rid of junk. Some of the largest sources of refuse actually come from yard trimmings. Anyone who's spent a day cutting hedges will know why. Construction materials, rock, concrete, asphalt also add to our total. Earlier, we asked for your guesses of how much waste Oahu residents produce each day. The city and county receives more than 2,000 tons of waste per day on the 6 days it collects each week, which adds up to 4 million pounds, or about 4 pounds per person each day. We had a bit of fun trying to make sense of those numbers. 2,000 tons is about the same weight as 200 garbage trucks, 4.5 Boeing 747 planes, or 133 school buses. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hawaii Public Radio amplifies voices from all across the Hawaiian Island.
News, Ike Kupuna, Mele Mo'olelo, and more.
All in today's episode of the Hawaii Radio Hour from Kahilu.
From Hawaii Island comes Hawaii Radio Hour, part of our weekend lineup on HPR One and available as a podcast.
As Hawaiians, we live with one foot on this side in the here and the other foot in the hereafter. And for us, the ancestors are present in a real way.
Hawaii Radio Hour is part of our continued commitment to elevate Hawaii's diverse and distinct voices. Support Hawaii Public Radio's commitment to local programs. Become a monthly supporter by clicking donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
With only minimal damage from this weekend's storm, 13 Moons Tattoo in Pa'ia is officially open for business. The shop is the brainchild of a Maui-raised artist who grew up in the spotlight. Many may know Angel Rose from her appearances on 3 seasons of the hit reality competition show, Ink Master. She shared the top prize in the 13th season. That was 6 years ago. After the pandemic, she decided to move back home and build a pipeline for young talent, one she wishes had been available to her. The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with Rose about her hopes for the new shop. Rose starts with her winding path to tattooing.
I got into film production in high school, and I ended up pursuing that. That's what led me to the mainland. I went to film school in Southern California. I had a design class, and they required us to keep a drawing, like a daily sketchbook. And I've always been into art my whole life. It's something that, like, you don't need to be taught necessarily. Like, I didn't have art supplies as a kid. I just used ballpoint pens and whatever I had around to make art. So it just was something that came naturally to me. And it started me thinking, like, well, you know, I wanted to direct films, which is kind of a pipe dream, you know? knew that I could get it done. It was just a matter of, like, in the meantime, I'm going to need some kind of financial stability. And I thought, maybe I can do tattoos on the side. So I, you know, submitted my portfolio to this artist, and they immediately were like, we want you, get in here, basically. And I got there and they were like, oh, tattooing's not a side gig. My mentor literally said to me, I will not apprentice anyone who doesn't want to be the best tattoo artist in the world. And that sort of put it all into perspective for me, and also just awakened kind of a fire in me. I was like, well, this is the coolest thing ever. That is sort of where that ultimately started. Long story short, you know, an apprenticeship is really demanding, and being a film student is also really demanding. And there came a point where I was sort of losing my mind because I couldn't keep up with all of it, and I wasn't sleeping, I wasn't eating. It was bad. One of my friends was like, you're going to need to make a decision. And I was like, no, I'd rather die. And then my school ironically closed down like 2 weeks after that conversation. And yeah, the owner like left the country. It was crazy. But it felt like a sign, right? Like that I was supposed to be tattooing. And so I, you know, I leaned into that. Sometime later, I was, you know, on my own tattooing and kind of like trying to make it work in LA. And not long into my career is when Ink Master called me. A lot of the rest, everybody knows because we've been on so much TV since then. Yeah. So that kind of brings you along the timeline a little bit.
It does. That's interesting. I didn't realize that's how Ink Master scouted, that they reach out to folks and like recruit. But is there anything behind the scenes about that process you can share? Was there an auditioning process to get on the show that first time?
Yeah, like a little bit. Usually you get scouted. Most of the people I know get scouted. And then a bunch more people who aren't interested in Ink Master get scouted. And they're always like, oh, should I say yes? And I always tell people, yes, you should. So I was 22 at the time. I was a theater kid and a film kid. At first, I was like kind of too cool for it. Not too cool, just like a lot of tattooers sort of write off Ink Master because there's a lot about it that's not like a realistic simulation of what tattooing is like, which is fair. It's a TV show. But I was kind of like, I shouldn't do that to people. I shouldn't like, you know, use people's skin for a contest. And then my parents were sort of like, Angel, you need to chill. you could actually win this. You need to go try. And I was like, yeah, you're right. I'm getting in my head. So I responded to them and I said yes. And then you have to go through like a series of interviews. You do just like a bunch of video interviews. And I just remember kind of hamming it up and being like, I'm going to be so interesting in these videos because I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to make myself valuable to them. And I sort of, from going to film school, sort of knew the other half of it, like how to, what kind of things are interesting and what people want to see and what kind of stories we want to tell and that sort of thing. I was also a theater kid, so I was just a nerd. And so, yeah, and then before I know it, I'm like 3-4 interviews in, and then we have to do a background check. I have to do a psych eval. There's a lot of stuff you have to do and about a million pieces of paper to sign. And I think I signed the same packet, I don't know, like 35 times just because they're so thorough, you know? And then in the meantime, too, you sign an NDA, so you're not allowed to tell anybody that this is happening. And I remember I had done the whole show, and it was under wraps, like super tight, you know? Nobody knew that I had done it yet. And then I get a call from my friend from high school, like, how come you didn't tell me you're on Ink Master? And I was like, how do you know about that? You know, because I have an NDA that says they can sue me for like $2 million or whatever it is. You know, I'm like, why do you know about that? And she was like, oh, my stepmom told me. Like, your stepmom, how did she find out? It was my stepmom that told her, and I call her like, hey, Coconut Wireless, you need to stop. Like, this is an island. Everyone will know.
That's so funny. You're like, I can get sued. Like, stop, auntie, stop
no,
talking.
No, not a single auntie can know on Maui, or the whole island will know. So that was funny. It scared me at the time. Now I've done it a bunch of times. It's, you know, it's not as intimidating. But yeah, so that's sort of what the process was like for me. I personally just kind of had fun with it. And then before you know it, you're getting on a plane and you're going out there. I think I might have been 23 by the time I flew. But I was a baby, you know, and I was only a few years into tattooing. I was really only about a year into tattooing on my own. when they called me. So it was one of those things where it's like, you don't expect anything life is going to throw at you, and you kind of have to say yes and just handle it, you know?
Talk a bit about your decision to move back to Maui. What did you have to have in place for you to make it happen?
You know what? It's one of those things where, like, I traveled all around the U.S. and everywhere I went, I would tell people, you know, oh, are you from California? No, I'm from Hawaii. And people would just look at me like, why did you leave? And I didn't have much of an answer. It was like, you got to see the world a little bit. You know, I had to go and do my main storyline. You know, I got to go. I think there's a lot to be said about getting out and seeing the world and taking on some, like, bigger obstacles, you know. But then I realized as I was, like, you know, getting 8, 6, 8, 10 years in, I was like, I'm so homesick. I'm so not, I don't feel like I belong anywhere else that I've lived. And I started to realize, oh my God, it's not easy to get back here. You know, I should have stayed. I should have stayed and laid down roots, because, you know, this is a place that, like, people can scarcely dream of like purchasing a house here or opening a business here. I already had the dream, like, in my heart for probably almost 5 years prior to actually coming here. And then, you know, then there was the timing with the Lahaina fires and everything. And I just was like, I gotta go home. Because this community, I'm always really passionate. Everywhere I go, I do things and I do community work, but I felt like Maui is the one community that raised me, that turned me into who I am. And now more than ever, I felt so connected to it. And so, like my purpose was renewed. I need to get back home. I need to return with the elixir, and I need to do amazing things there, because just, you know, I can, you know, all of my giving back and everything is all good, but I felt like, yeah, Maui's the place that raised me, and that's where I want to be. And so I finally, you know, I had a dream of buying a house here, and everybody's like, why are you doing that? It's so expensive. It's so much. I mean, you know, it's not a big house because you can't. But I was stubborn. And I remember talking to a friend of mine, and she was like, you know, for every house that gets sold, it's usually somebody from the mainland. You know, how many of us who were born and raised here actually have homes here? You know, and I thought about it, and I was like, yeah, I don't want to be that statistic, you know? And so I was stubborn, and now I'm here, and now it's expensive and whatever, we're going to figure it out. You know, and that's life. And that's what a lot of people, that's why there's so many locals that'll never leave. They're like, nah, I'm not going anywhere. I don't belong anywhere else. You know, it's been a long journey and I've had to do a lot to get here, but I'm happy.
Yeah. What advice would you have for other people in similar situations? And I mean, it's the cost of living, but it also is, I think, to some degree, the brain drain, the idea that if you want to have experiences and opportunities, the place to do that is on the continent and not at home.
Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like it's a catch 22, right? Like, because I had to go mainland for, like, to make all this happen. I had to, you know, like, I could have, maybe Master would have scouted me, but probably not. I was in LA. But the thing is, as soon as you leave, whatever your property value is, whatever you leave behind when you go, triples in value when you come back. And so to buy the same house you would have had, you're going to be so much farther behind. So I think it's one of those things. It's just, I have only ever, you know, kind of entered into this crazy financial system that we have in this world in order to kind of chase that happiness, you know? And I've always said, like, I don't want money to have it. I want money to use it. It's one of those things. I knew I was going to have to be stubborn, and I was going to have to dig my heels in and have everybody tell me I'm crazy in order to get here. But I don't care, because I'm here now. And I think that I talked to a couple of other, you know, I would talk to people here and there, other Hawaiians on the continent that would hear that, and they would cry, because when you're over there, and people are saying stuff like that, you know, you start talking about home and how important it is, it's emotional. because nothing over there is like this. It's not. And I spent enough time to know that, like, and I moved around enough over there too to know, like, nothing's going to be home, you know? So, yeah, I just knew it was going to be, I was going to have to be really stubborn. And so I did it. And now I'm here, and now we're going to build even bigger dreams. So, yeah, I wanted to have a shop here where I could, you know, bring my connections in the tattoo world from the mainland, you know, home to help enrich the community here, to, you know, do educational stuff, to talk to art students, all that stuff, bring them here to help bring all of the stuff that I've learned from my crazy career. Just wanted to bring it home and sort of like help elevate the tattoo community here, you know, raise money and do all this stuff, you know, volunteer and all these things. But I just thought, you know, I'm sitting on this, on all of these connections and all of this crazy story that I've had. I got to do something with it, you know. So we're opening a shop, hopefully get some new really cool artists in there, and then start a guest artist program to sort of start to give back, you know.
Like create some of that pipeline that you maybe wish that you had had.
Yeah, I would love for Hawaii to be recognized as a staple in the tattoo community. I mean, I think to some extent it is, you know, there's obviously our like ancestral culture here. Obviously tattoos are a huge deal. Hawaii has some of the oldest tattoo shops in the US because of the sailors. But I more than anything want modern tattooing to be accessible here for the incredible artists that are coming out of my hometown. You know, I don't want them to have to fly to the mainland to have the same experiences that I've had, you know, in the same community that I've had. I don't want them to have to move away for 10 years to get a part of that. You know, I want our homegrown artists to have resources and connections within our own community.
That was Maui tattoo artist Angel Rose, who owns 13 Moons Tattoo in Pa'ia. Her shop is now open for bookings and walk-ins. Check out our website later today for details.
Another day, another dollar. Boy, I got it pretty nice. Why let it go so easy? Comfort's just a sacrifice. I grow from the pain within me. But what do I do with this? So now what do I do with to me?
That wraps it up for today. Tomorrow, we're planning a live call-in show to discuss the State Board of Education's plan to restrict cell phone use in schools. Do you think phones have a place in the classroom? We want to hear from you. Leave a voicemail on our talkback line before the show by calling 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find the conversation on our website or as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Robbie Dingman. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.